studied. But if a student has studied and now he has some stresses, if a teacher comes to talk to him, to tell him the basic points of the lessons, it will have some effects because he or she has already studied. Now, the point is that when the people pass away, according to Islamic teachings and according to Islamic philosophy as well, the connection is not cut off completely between the soul and the body.
Okay.
At least for a couple of hours or a couple of days, there is still a connection between the soul and the body. And there are many arguments for that. I mean, especially those people who tell you about the NDE, near-death experience, they also refer to the fact that although they feel the separation between the soul and the body, but they are watching the body and they see the people around. So there is a kind of relation, connection between the soul and the body. And that is why the soul is around the body. So it's been mentioned by some of the Muslim philosophers too, that the connection still continues, and gradually the connection may be cut off for many people.
Okay.
And that is why we have in some of the narrations that when you're doing the funeral ceremony, do not put the dead body directly into the grave. Do it through stages.
Yes.
I mean, you are carrying the coffin, so put it on the earth for some minutes maybe.
Reciting of the namaz of the mayyit.
And then gradually you may put the corpse inside the grave. What is the reason?
Okay.
This reason is that the dead person is afraid of going into the grave.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the fact that there is a kind of connection between the dead body and the soul, it may have a good effect on the soul not to be put, for the body not to be put in the grave directly.
Okay.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
You'll find your way. That is why we address the dead body.
That's right.
Ifham, and the main addressee is the soul, of course. But because of that connection, which is still there between the body and the soul, we are talking to that person, like Isma, Ifham, listen, understand, sure.
So this is because of reducing the fear of, we can say, the death and the separation of the soul from the body.
Yeah, but reminding them of the basic beliefs.
Beliefs are for the Muslims, exactly. That's all right.
Yeah.
But does it change anything? For example, if the dead person has been a corrupted one or something like that, does it have any effect on the soul, on the dark soul of a corrupted or, for example, a sinful person or not?
As I told you before, it doesn't change the destiny of a person altogether. Mm-hmm. We are not talking about sinful people who are wicked people. We are not talking about the unbelievers. No, it doesn't have any effect for them. Let me refer back to the examples that I mentioned. If a student has not studied at all, it doesn't make any change if before the exam, if a teacher comes to him and talks to him to remind him of the main messages, of the main lessons. No, it doesn't make any change.
Yes.
But if he has studied, but now he has too much stresses.
Yes.
So if a teacher comes and talks to him and reminds him of the main points, it will have some effect for him to just remember the main points. So the same is true about the concept of talqin. We are talking about good believers who may have committed some sins, but the point is that at the end of the day, we are going from one realm to another realm, which may bring us so much fears. And that is why the concept of talqin helps people who have already been good believers in this world just to be reminded of the main
pillars of the religion of Islam.
Exactly.
Can it be read out to a non-Muslim too?
No.
No, it's not possible
no.
to have, for example, Talghin and Mayyit to a non-Muslim. Okay.
Yeah, because of right. the phrases that we mentioned, yes. they are addressing a Muslim. This
Muslim.
Is one point.
Yes.
And the second point, I believe that Talghin and Mayyit has an effect for the people around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for the lot
as
of
a
people.
Reminder.
It's a kind of reminder
yes,
for them.
That's right.
If I have time, I may read
Very good.
The listener some parts
some
of the
parts
phrases.
Of it, yes, with the English translation.
Yeah, sure. So for the people who are at the deathbed, they are alive, you have some narration, for example, to ask them to repeat La ilaha illallah al-halim al-kareem, La ilaha illallah al-ali al-azim, and the rest, which are about the monotheism and some of the features and attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But when a person passes away and they are put in the grave, we have the following phrases like Isma' ifham ya fulan ibn fulan, like ya
yes.
Muhammad ibn Ali, for example.
Son of that
exactly.
father, and it's named by the father, isn't it?
Yeah.
Son or girl or daughter of father.
Yeah, if we have a female, then we have the daughter
yes,
of
yes.
her father, and
okay.
all the verbs and the pronouns
yes.
are in feminine form.
Yes, good.
So we say, listen, understand. هل أنت على العهد الذي فارقتنا عليه? Are you still following the covenant with which you left us?
Mm-hmm.
What is that covenant? To witness that there is no God but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that Muhammad is our prophet. And then we mention the names of all the imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And then we say that إِذَا أَتَاكَ الْمَلَكَانِ الْمُقَرَّبَانِ. We believe in the concept of two angels coming in the world of Barzakh to ask different questions. So we say that when the two angels come to you, they ask you about your God, your father, your prophet, your religion, your book, your Qibla. Then give the following answers. Of course, again, I repeat, already he knows the answers in this world. But maybe because of the fears of the next realm, we have this concept of talqin for him to remember all these points.
Yes.
And as I mentioned, it has an effect for the people who are watching, the other Muslims, believers who are
yes.
Who have taken part in this funeral ceremony to just know about the reality of the next world.
That's right.
And finally, we tell him that, Ya fulan ibn fulan, do not be fearful. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because in Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, ni'mar rab. We have the best Lord, if you may put it
yes.
in this way. And Prophet Muhammad is the best prophet, and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam are the best leaders. And then we repeat, and then we refer to some of the beliefs about the hereafter, the fact that al-mawta haq, death is a truth.
Yes.
And the question of the two angels are truth, and the resurrection is truth, sirat is a truth, and so on and so forth, which not only help that diseased person, but also, as I mentioned, it's a kind of reminder for the people who have taken part in the funeral ceremony.
We have so much to say about the posthumous, we can say, experiences of a dead person. Is this talqin and giving, for example, the news of not being fearful of the grave and the other things based on a riwayat, or do we have any verse of the ayah of the Holy Quran confirming such an act that the posthumous experience will be something fearful?
Yeah, as I mentioned, some of the narrations explicitly refer to the fact that, I mean, generally speaking, the believers are fearful of the
mm-hmm.
next realm. Because as some narrations read, I mean, it's just like a fetus who is going to be born. And what are the differences between the realm of his or her mother womb and this world? The same is true about this world and the next world, which is the world of Barzakh.
Yes.
To be alone in that realm. So, I mean, logically speaking, it would bring so much fears for the people. So the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt have referred to this fear, and they have referred to some points for the people to reduce this fear for the people who have passed away.
Yes.
As I mentioned, when we are carrying the dead person in the coffin, the narrations talk about the fact that reduce the fear by doing that through stages.
Yes.
So these narrations are directly referring to the point that you mentioned. In another narration, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was asked by Ishaq ibn Ammar that if the mu'min has any kind of reaction regarding those people who go to his grave to visit him, and the Imam said yes, as long as they are with him, especially we have some narrations both in Shia and Sunni collections of hadith, for the day that he or she is buried,
yes.
they have, I mean, direct reactions to the people who come to them to, I mean, take part in the funeral ceremony. So as long as the people are with him or her, they are happy because they do not, I mean, feel alone. But when they, I mean, people leave him, they become more fearful. And that is why it is recommended for the close relatives not to leave the grave very soon after burying
That's
the
right.
dead person.
Okay.
And it is still because of that connection between the soul and the body.
That's right.
So all these Darushans refer to the fact that, yes, first of all, the fear is there. And
yes.
second of all, there are some deeds and acts to be done by other people to reduce that fear, one of them being Talqin al-Mayyit.
That's all right. All in all, we could say that the religion of Islam has plans for a person's lifetime from cradle to grave.
Exactly.
And this is really important, especially about the religious formulas that are recited when a child is born, azan and aqama,
mm-hmm.
recited in the ears of the child. And when a person is, we can't say, being buried, again, there are some religious formula to be recited to leave this world in a religious manner. May Allah help us, inshallah, to have a fruitful life, religiously speaking, and to have, we can say, be a spiritually grown up, inshallah. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Karimi, it was very kind of you. Really, I enjoyed talking to you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي تهران
روباشافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
رشا سغلام اسطنبول
سيد امين عالمي كابول
شهان بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Bakeries from around Italy have warned the government that their activities are at risk of shutting down if they won't receive financial help as soon as possible. Trade associations and representatives of the bakery industry met the Business and Made in Italy Minister Adolfo Urso on Friday to demand subsidies and safeguard measures to tackle the dramatic rise in the cost of raw materials, such as flour, diesel oil, packaging and equipment.
Flour has gone up from around 4.5 euros per kilo to around 8 euros. The cost of mozzarella has gone up by 30%, that of tomatoes has doubled, and the same goes with cost of equipment. The government must do something to save bakeries, as we are disappearing. The quality and freshness of products from small specialized stores like ours is hard to beat.
Smaller family-owned bakery shops in Italy are slowly disappearing, giving place to large supermarkets. A cost of living crisis, rising inflation and energy prices have badly affected many of the around 26,000 bakeries, which employ about 100,000 workers across the country. Power bills have doubled in Italy over the past months amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war. This is while the country's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
All prices have increased a lot. The cost of energy, raw materials, everything has gone up by at least 40%.
Prices have gone up also in supermarkets where there is no more food in offer. But where prices have gone insane is at work. I am employed by a communication agency and the quotations we receive have doubled.
Earlier this week, the Giorgia Meloni government announced its draft 2023 budget bill, which includes measures aimed at channeling 35 billion euros towards families and businesses in order to ease the burden of high inflation and power bills. Many fear these measures will do little to shield the Italians. Max Civili, Rome.
tens of thousands of activists from Imran Khan's PTI party, who came from all across Pakistan, chanted anti-government slogans demanding immediate elections, accusing the government for what they called following US-backed policies. The protesters held the ruling party responsible for the current economic crisis. They said Imran Khan is the only leader who could bring political and economic stability to Pakistan.
Our leader Imran Khan is fighting with the corrupt mafia who was brought by the US. Our struggle is for the rule of law in the country, and that is only possible when Imran Khan will be in power.
Having survived an assassination attempt during his anti-government march on the 3rd of November, former Prime Minister Imran Khan joined the protesters in person for the first time in 3 weeks amid stringent security. Khan told his supporters that although his life is under threat, he will continue his political struggle until his demands are met.
This imported government was brought to a US conspiracy for corruption purposes. We will not accept this puppet regime, and we will fight till the end for fresh polls. We will dissolve our provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in days to come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan's supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is not a lecture, but a picket line. Lecturers, librarians, and researchers are out here as part of a massive strike across the country. 150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly.
and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualized, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualized.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reason. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purza, London.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions, but so far I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months. World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems, and the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy. But we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
The U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than 2 decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The EU is currently paying more for gas than any other region in the world. The European Commission had proposed to cap natural gas prices at €275 per megawatt hour. The idea was totally rubbished by the bloc's energy ministers at a meeting on Thursday.
A ceiling between 150 and 200 euro is a realistic ceiling, and this could help us reduce gas prices and therefore reduce electricity prices.
But any sort of a cap could result in gas suppliers moving their tankers to other parts of the world where there is no cap, like Asia.
If we really see that this mechanism is designed in the way that that we will lose LNG cargoes to other international markets, then we can suspend it.
As things stand in the EU, there is no guarantee of a manageable gas price or even a gas supply for 2023.
If we cannot keep our economy running, we will not be able to support Ukraine, and we must do everything to avoid such scenario.
Those representing small to medium-sized businesses are looking for EU support amid high inflation and growing interest rates.
If we not want to fight unemployment and a youth unemployment, we need to take care about the growth and competitiveness of European SMEs.
A debate in the European Parliament this week on promoting stability in the Middle East heard that the initiative would help ensure energy security for the EU. However, one lawmaker raised the West's previous actions in the region.
Leaving broken countries, hobbled economies, violence, trauma and permanent conflict. And at the end of that, we stroke our chins, pretend we've nothing to do about it and ask how we are going to promote stability in the region. You have got to be joking.
EU energy ministers will meet again on the 13th of December to try and reach agreement on the vital question of 2023 gas supplies. Analysts say this crisis best illustrates how sanctions against Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France.
How cynical is it that NGOs filling this gap and saving lives are criminalised, whereas the states violating their obligation enjoy impunity?
Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets.
How dare so many of you define yourself as Christians and repeat that you are defending Christian values when your ideas and your actions are proof of the opposite?
In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees.
How did Lega get big? How did the AfD get big? How did Marine Le Pen get big? It's all by capitalizing on the fears of migration.
The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdullahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdullahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordow nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump does not shy away from directly or indirectly expressing racist opinions and emphasizing the suppression of anti-racism protesters. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Agence France-Presse has covered this story. The Biden White House has blasted former President Donald Trump for meeting at his Florida estate, Mar-a-Lago, with a notorious white supremacist, Nick Fuentes, and with the disgraced rapper, Kanye West. Donald Trump had dinner with Nick Fuentes on Tuesday night, 22nd of November, alongside rapper Kanye West. At his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida, Trump posted on his Truth Social account late on Friday, 25th of November, he said, "I didn't know Nick Fuentes." White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates, on Saturday, 26th of November, condemned Donald Trump's meeting with Nick Fuentes. Bates told CNN, "Bigotry, hate, and anti-Semitism have absolutely no place in America, including at Mar-a-Lago. White supremacy is dangerous, and it must be forcefully condemned." President Joe Biden, however, ducked a question about Donald Trump's dinner with the white nationalist. "You don't want to hear what I think," he said. Trump formally entered the 2024 race for the White House recently, his third serious presidential bid, and his embrace of a white nationalist unsettled some of his one-time administration officials. So far, he's the only prominent Republican to enter the race to challenge Joe Biden. In the meantime, multiple other GOP officials and members of the Trump administration have voiced their readiness to take part in the 2024 U.S. presidential race. Among the more prominent Republican volunteers include former Vice President Mike Pence, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. According to a political analyst and a former congressional candidate, Donald Trump has a very long history going back to his father of being a white supremacist. Miles Honig said, "As a landlord in New York, he clearly was overtly racist in his practices and passed along these traits to Donald Trump when he started to be involved in the housing and rental industry." Miles Honig added, "Throughout his 2016 presidential campaign, he targeted non-whites, especially Latinos, classifying all of them as drug dealers and criminals." Honig said, "His entire immigration policy is to refuse entry to people from African and Islamic countries and bring in people from places like Norway." Adding, "During the Charlottesville new Nazi rally, where one woman was murdered, Donald Trump said there were good people on both sides." Meanwhile, The Hill newspaper has also covered the same story. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie slammed former President Donald Trump's awful lack of judgment for his meeting with disgraced rapper Kanye West and white nationalist Nick Fuentes. Chris Christie said, "This is just another example of an awful lack of judgment from Donald Trump, which, combined with his past poor judgments, make him an untenable general election candidate for the Republican Party in 2024. Chris Christie's comments come after Donald Trump became the first major GOP candidate to announce his candidacy for president recently. The former president has received some of the blame for the party's lackluster performance in the midterm elections. Several Trump-backed candidates in high-profile races lost to their Democratic opponents in midterm elections. A number of candidates Donald Trump endorsed defeated primary opponents who were seen as more competitive candidates but were less loyal to the former president." And amid the finger-pointing, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has gained traction as a viable 2024 GOP presidential nominee. Opinion polls since the midterm elections have shown Trump's support somewhat declining compared to that of Ron DeSantis, who has been rumored to be considering his own 2024 presidential bid. Polling previously indicated that DeSantis had most support among Republican alternatives to Trump in a 2024 primary, but the former president led by much larger margins than he has recently. Chris Christie and several other major Republican Party leaders have called for the GOP to move on from Donald Trump. Chris Christie told The Times that hosting Nick Fuentes and Kanye West was a matter of getting attention. He said he can't stand not having attention all the time, and so having someone show up at his club, even if you believe that he didn't know who Nick Fuentes was and want to sit with him, feeds the hunger he feels for the attention he's missing since he left the presidency. Donald Trump said in a Truth Social post after the meeting that Kanye West had asked to meet him, but that he did not know who Nick Fuentes was. The British newspaper The Guardian has more details. US Democrats, anti-racist groups, and some Republicans have condemned Donald Trump for having a dinner with American white supremacist Nick Fuentes. After details of their encounter at the former US President's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida emerged. The meeting is the latest in a long line of incidents involving the former president and the far right, including once referring the Proud Boys in a presidential debate and his comments that there were very fine people on both sides after 2017 clashes at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that left one person dead. Donald Trump has admitted he met Nick Fuentes, who is open about his extreme racist views on his podcast, during a dinner with Kanye West, the disgraced rapper. The meeting was roundly condemned. Jonathan Greenblatt, the chief executive of the Anti-Defamation League, which campaigns against bigotry and racism, condemned Donald Trump's meeting with Nick Fuentes and expressed shock at the development. Jonathan Greenblatt told the New York Times, "Nick Fuentes is among the most prominent and unapologetic racists in this country. He's a vicious bigot and white supremacist who has been condemned by leading figures from both political parties." Democrats joined in the criticism. Democratic National Committee spokesperson Amar Moussa said in a statement that the move should see Trump, who recently announced a 2024 White House run, barred from representing the Republican Party. Democratic National Committee spokesperson Amar Moussa said, "If it was any other party, breaking bread with Nick Fuentes would be instantly disqualifying for Trump. The most extreme views have found a home in today's MAGA Republican Party."
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. This is Brother Muhammad speaking to you from the Youth Station IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I hope you're all doing well. I am Beta, a medical student, and that's my pleasure to be here in this episode. Today, I'm gonna actually narrate a story for you. The story of Isaac Newton, which I think he is really famous around the world because, you know, finding the gravitation and something like that. He is, kind of distinguished science, he is a distinguished professor in physics and mathematics. But there are many evidences that tells us that this person was really aggressive. you know, to mm-hmm. the extent that just he was threatening his family to burn them in the fire. Mm-hmm. And he was like, okay, he couldn't interact with any other people. Most of the people just narrated that he was really aggressive and, you know, they were unable to interact with these people. As you know, even in our day-to-day life, there are many people who are really educated. They have PhDs, they're doctors, surgeons. And, you know, there are people who have studied for many years, like 30 years old, but you know, you cannot communicate with them. They lack mm-hmm. something.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we deal with these people almost every day. The question would boil down to whether an educated person mm-hmm. Is he necessarily a person of value? No, I also have that same point, because I don't know if you've encountered Isaac Newton, but I haven't. I've encountered other people who have a lot of education,
yeah,
and maybe whatever field they're in, but their morals, their ethics, zero. You just look at them.
Honor zero, I think.
Yeah, and because it's actually the education doesn't really have any effect on, you know, morals.
You know, I think, you know, the actual factor that makes education important in ethics and morals is that when you're educated, you are interacting with educated people too, mostly.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I think that should actually affect you, but it doesn't. Why?
Yeah, but interactions do really affect, but let's say you're not an educated person, you're an ordinary person.
Yeah.
Who do you interact with? You interact with the shops, you interact with the, you know, your family, your people around you, your siblings and whatnot. Now, does it mean that if you're not educated, you're going to have better interaction? No. You've seen the other opposite as well. Those who are illiterate, they're normally aggressive as well because they don't understand certain things. The education is not necessarily the red line or the criteria of better morals or ethics, but I think it has a lot of effect on it.
Yeah, you know, it should have, but yeah. I think it doesn't. This is the way I think.
No, it does. You just don't take an exception from history and judge upon that, Isaac Newton. But take a look at, for example, Einstein. Yeah. So Einstein, he was actually a very ethical person, though maybe not with his family, but he was an ethical person outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is an example of an educated person who's also ethical.
So there are many examples, both from this part of, that, okay, education cannot bring insight or understanding. And also there are many examples from the other part. But in my opinion, I think you cannot actually choose the people you're gonna communicate with mm-hmm. By their education. But I think there is always this feeling that, okay, I'm, for example, educated, but that people is illiterate. And there is always a feeling
that
you are superior.
Yeah, you're,
yeah exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
What should we do?
But aren't you superior if you're educated? Aren't you? That's the question. Are you going to equalize a person with no education and a person with education?
You know, that's actually really difficult.
See, that's a very important question,
yeah,
right?
That is really difficult, but again, I have this feeling. It's not about thinking, it's about feeling.
Yeah, I'm against judgmental. I'm against judging people based on their education, right? But aren't you valuable, more valuable with education? Though your ethics and morals, let me tell you one thing. With education, right, would you be the same person when you were in grade 1 and when you were in grade 12? You're a completely different person.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's not only your maturity, your physical development, your mental development, but it's also your education. Because the things you knew in grade 1, right,
yeah,
and the things you know in grade 12, mm-hmm. that systematic education I'm talking about, is completely elevated.
Yeah,
so whatever you were in grade 1, now you think back at grade 1, you'd be like, oh, I learned this so difficult, but it's so easy now. There are people who are in grade 3 that have difficulties with multiplications, but now they're in, for example, they've chosen mathematics as their, you know, as their field of study. Now, what does this mean? This means that they've actually developed their value in education. But again, being judgmental, it all comes back to the ethics of that person. Now, another important, there is a big difference between ethics and insight.
Yeah, actually, there is a lot of difference. Actually, there is a gap, I think, here between these two, and they are somehow completely different. But right now, I'm talking like, okay, an educated person is, you know, somehow more probable and likely to actually be more ethical. I mean, the likelihood of it could be higher. Do you agree with that one or not? The likelihood of being an ethical person in the educated people is higher than
illiterate
ones.
Because, I remember when
you are judging.
By
the level of education.
It
is a bit of judging, you know.
Being educated. Look, even the illiterate people, they would really respect the educated, Like, if you look at the elderly when they're in the, I don't know, if you're in the mosque or wherever you are, at least my father respects my brother whenever he comes into it because he's more educated.
Yeah, or my sister. I do agree with that. So, you know, let's go for a break then. We're going to go for our cliffhanger. Dear listeners, stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to my voice from Youth Station. We're talking about the connection between the morality and ethical contents with the education of a special group of people. And, you know, my brother is telling me that, okay, if you see someone who is educated or illiterate, you cannot actually judge him or her by this level of education. But, you know, I'm telling you that we're not talking about the judgment. We're talking about the likelihood of it, you know. When the likelihood of something is higher in, for example, a special group, you go through that. You go for the more interaction with that group. And this is somehow a bit of sort of judgment that you are having a background of something and you are acting according to that background. I'm not telling you that this is true, but this is the way
natural.
It is.
You see, it's natural in the society. Let me give an example. Doctors, right? They are generally considered a very humane set of people, right? You, at least the people expect that from them. Doctors, when they go to, they expect, they're going to be very kind to them. They expect, they're going to explain to them the humanitarian stuff. And but then you find some doctors, unfortunately, in the society that are not moral. They're not kind. They don't care about the health of the people. All they're doing is just taking money from the people. And whether the person is cured or not, it doesn't matter for
and
them.
And I wish it was just like not caring about the health. They just don't care about even the life.
They see it as if it's like, for example, a piece of meat in front of them.
You know, you cannot even judge these people because after a long term, for example, 20 years, you are working on something and you are seeing people dying. And, you know, you get used to that.
Yeah, you get used to that. But then does that mean that you have to get away from the humanity?
No, at all.
You should not. So it's very important. Likewise, with educated people, it's the same thing. You'd expect because you see all the people educated around you are respectable people. Mm-hmm. They're humble people. But then you find one bad apple and that person is kind of, so that's why at the beginning of the discussion I kept emphasizing that the criteria of morals and ethics is not necessarily education.
Yeah,
education might help in morals and ethics, but it's not now
the main factor.
Another point, now separate from ethics and morals, what about insight? How do you think educate helps in a person's insight, his understanding, his personal and social understanding?
You know, I think when you're more educated and you know more about this world, you just think about, okay, there is a world that is somehow superior to me. And this feeling of feeling inferior of something will actually urge you and persuade you to go for searching your questions and searching for where you are, where is your level of creation. And I think this is the main thing that will improve your insight when you are educated. And I think, actually, as you told me, there is a difference between ethics and morals and insight, because I think there is a strong bond and connection between insight and education. And I think this connection is somehow stronger than the connection that exists between the morals and ethics and education.
The general concept of it, but when you look in the society, at least let me tell you, like I've been in a country where there are educated people who have this they don't have ethical problem, they don't have moral problem, but their understanding of life is warped. You wouldn't be surprised that a person having, I don't know, 5-8, you know, degrees, PhDs in some, you know, physics, and then he still prostrates in front of an idol.
Yeah.
So how did this man of so much of degrees and so much of honor, educational honor that is, ended up prostrating in front of an idol, right? So education, like I said, has an effect on almost every aspect of life. But with regards to insight, it's very, very delicate that we look into this. And people with education, like in a country, I can tell you, for example, in South America, educated people, especially when it comes to politics, oh my God, educated people in politics, they take sides. What is their rationale? There is no rationale for that.
Yeah.
But they lack insight. They lack insight.
So touching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd see that, at least I can tell you in Guyana, there are Africans and Indians, Afro-Guyanese and Indo-Guyanese. And both have political parties.
Mm.
And they're very segregated. It's a very big issue. And guess who is ruling them? Guess who is giving them, feeding them information?
Who?
It's the educated people.
Yeah.
Would you imagine an educated person with so much of education having this insight of racialism again in itself?
Exactly.
So I think it's not just education. Many things affect culture, your upbringing.
Parents. Yeah,
all of this has an effect. But education is very important. Education does have an effect, but it's not the complete effect.
It's not all. Dear listeners, go for a short break. Stay tuned. There is another factor which somehow hides the effect of education, which is when you are educated and you think you are superior, there is a feeling of prejudice. There is a feeling of pride in you that you feel like, I'm so superior than you and you cannot tell me what to do
arrogancy,
or not to do.
Arrogancy.
And you feel arrogant about whatever you have, whatever you've achieved up to here. And I'm not telling you that that is irrational to be arrogant because you spend a lot of time, for example, 30 years on a special field and you have something to tell, but it doesn't mean that you know everything about any topic. You know?
Oh, that's very common in universities. Yeah. I can recall like a few teachers for one of my family members when he wanted to write his thesis. Oh my God, like the teacher would deal with him as if he was recently born.
Mm.
And he was like empty-minded. Though this guy was, you know, enthusiastic to work in that. But because this teacher was in this field for a long time, this professor was in this field for a very long time, he would belittle anyone who comes in front of him and doing that same topic or anything related to that. And yeah, education really becomes a hijab, rather. It becomes something that, you know, blurs your eyes.
Yeah.
The more you're educated sometimes, the more arrogant you become. But generally speaking, with the encounters that I have had, educated people are kind of still respectable people. And I still believe that they have more value than others, but they shouldn't be judged and they should not be judging others based on education.
Yeah, I do agree with your opinion, actually. At least, so let's go for a gist of our second episode. We were telling that, okay, there should be a connection between education and insight, morals, ethics, and other parts. But the most important thing is education is not everything. And you have to understand that maybe you can find some illiterate people that are somehow more ethical than other parts. And but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't respect the educated people because they spend their times on something and they gain this profession, you know, and you have to respect that and you have to understand that because you know something in a special field, it doesn't mean that you know everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to maintain your balance in your interactions, whether you are illiterate or educated. You have to use your education. If you have the opportunity to be educated, be a nice man in your life.
I second your opinion. Being educated, yes, it does bring value, but be careful before you're blurred by your education.
Yeah.
And you see people, you be careful before you belittle people. It's very important. Your education should not hinder you from being a very good social person in the society.
So thank you for all the time that you shared with me. This is all the time that we had. I wish you enjoyed the episode of today. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.